Yeah, maybe not.
Amen.
You guys are too shy. Psalm 142, what a great psalm it is. As we begin to see this wonderful cumulative effect coming and beginning from Psalm 138 and going to Psalm 145. These are psalms of David, and we believe that they are musings of David, in particular of past events as he reflects upon the different things that he went through and the way that he responded. He, in many respects, begins to teach us how to appropriately respond to these particular situations. So we kind of walk through with him, and we look at the very beginning in Psalm 138 and begin to realize that in starting a relationship with God, you has to always start with giving thanks, right? I mean, you can't come to God not giving thanks first. Interesting way of putting it in Psalm 95, verse 2, it says, come before his presence with thanksgiving. That's actually telling you how to come before God. You want to come before God and you want to see great things happen, you want to come with thanksgiving. No matter what the request is and no matter how intense your situation is, there has to be that level of faith that believes that God's going to do great things and he's going to do the right thing. That's the reason why it's put the way it's put in Philippians. And once again, just by way of reflection, I know you know the passage pretty well, but in Philippians chapter 4, let's just read the way that he puts it within the passage. He says that you and I need to rejoice in the Lord always in verse 4. And again, I say, rejoice. Now it says this in verse 6, be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving. Let your requests be made known to God. So you want audience with God? You're going to have to come in his presence with thanksgiving. I believe God. I thank you for your goodness, and I thank you that I can even come to you, that you hear me. As the psalmist says, I love the Lord because he hears me. You want to start with thanksgiving. We give you thanks, God. And he comes in a Psalm 139, and there's a realization in this particular psalm that you and I need to ask the Lord to reveal things to us that only he knows. Unfortunately, many times we're just satisfied with coming to God with the things that are obvious to us, or maybe just we have pet sins that we don't feel real bad about admitting to God, but certain ones we don't even bring into play because for whatever reason. But the psalmist realizes, as one of the psalms, he puts it, acquit me of hidden faults. And he comes with the realization that there are probably a lot of things that I don't see. I think what David is telling us in Psalm 139 is there's nobody knows you better than God. He's intricately acquainted with all of our ways, and he's intimate with us in everything. And so you want to come and talk to him about your life. There's nobody that knows you better than him. And there's nobody that cares for you like him. And on top of that, there's nobody that knows your purpose and the plan for you like him. So he's going to direct you in the right steps. Come to him, ask him to search you, to try you, to see if there be any hurtful way in you. And the psalmist takes us from thanksgiving in Psalm 138 to come to God and ask him to examine you, to search out and to begin to reveal to you things that you don't know. Ask the only one really that truly knows you to really cleanse you of hurtful ways. And that's what you're asking for. Psalm 140 is dealing with turning to God alone for rescue, for preservation, for keeping you. In everything, you turn to God alone, and he's the one. And the way that it ends, it shouldn't surprise you in Psalm 140. The way that it ends is that you, what, give thanks? Yeah, verse 13, right? Mm-hmm. Surely the righteous will give thanks to thy name. The thing that identifies the righteous is not that they're perfect. The thing that identifies the righteous is they give God the glory. They come to God. They give him thanks. They recognize he's the one. He's the source of protection. He's the one that's going to take care of them. Therefore, they come to him for everything. Therefore, they're declared righteous. And it's the righteous that will give thanks because God hears the prayer of the humble. How do we know that? Well, I think it says it. Verse 12 of chapter 140. I know that the Lord will maintain the cause of the afflicted. Another way of putting that would be, and justice for the poor would be the humble. So God hears, God is attuned, and the broken and contrite spirit, of course, we know that God will not despise. David is saying, you want to come to God if you need help. Come to him. Psalm 141 specifically is dealing with asking God, really in a reverential heart and attitude, to guard what you say, to guard your lips. It's difficult when things are happening to you, and you know everybody has a way of dealing with the issues of their lives. But the psalmist says, you know, if I were you, I would shut it and ask God to help you shut it. That's my translation. The way that he puts it is, set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Verse 3, keep watch over the door of my lips. There's a recognition that I need to be quiet. I need to let God correct me. And look, if a righteous man comes up and he tells me that I've done something wrong, I'm going to accept it as something, a gift from God. It's a wonderful thing. Once again, Psalm 139, you're coming to God and you're going, okay, search me and try me and see if there be any wicked way in me. And somebody comes up and says, you know, there's something wrong here. And you go, who told you to come? God did. You just asked him to. So, you know, prepare yourself for that. If in fact you're praying the prayer, but there seems to be a real desire in his heart to do that. I mean, Lord, thank you for these people in my life that won't allow me to do the wrong thing. I'm just so thankful, you know. So it ends in Psalm 141 in the way that my eyes are toward thee, O Lord, and I'm just going to put my trust in you, and you're going to take care of the evil person. I don't feel like I have to. Take care of the evil person. They set a trap for themselves. You help them fall in it. But you help me pass by safely. You're going to take care of me. So, you know, sometimes the feeling is I got to correct that person. You know, you just have to let it go. Especially if they seem, you know, people can be pretty incorrigible. You can tell if they're receptive or not, right? And if they're not receptive, just go, okay, you know. Lord will take care of it. Just let the Lord take care of it. It's a better way to live, don't you think? Psalm 142 puts us in a situation, once again, a setting in which David is reflecting in his life. And it actually says at the top of this particular psalm where he is. Where is he? He's in the cave. And that's a cave. I don't know if you know. They recognize it in my drawing, but that's what that is. That's a cave. Somebody was thinking it was actually a mouth, but that's a cave. And so we're looking at the cave, and we're not only looking at a cave, but we're recognizing that David is in dire straits as he begins to reflect upon this. And, of course, once again, he's reflecting upon something that has already happened. But he's telling us what we need to do if something like this happens to you and me. How do we know that he's telling us and he's teaching us? Well, because the word maskil, that is another way of putting or saying to us that this is a didactic psalm, or more specifically, it's a psalm that focuses on teaching you and me something. So it's a teaching psalm. And he's going to be teaching us something that he went through, speaking from experience, and he's going to be telling you and I how to handle these particular things. The setting of this is that he is in the cave, and he is hiding, and we know that to the northwest is the king of Gath, which he just recently left, and we'll actually go to the passage and First Samuel that will talk about this. And we also know that Saul is to the northeast, and he's searching for David as well. So interestingly enough, both are only about 15 miles away. So the distance between them both. So, you know, when you feel like, you know, it's a pressure day, you have evil on both sides looking to get you, think of David. That's exactly what was happening to him in this particular point in time. The picture is drawn to us and drawn for us in 1 Samuel chapter 22, as it actually shows us that he went into this particular cave. It seems as if there's another psalm that deals with this particular time, although David has been in caves before and hiding. Another psalm that you might want to parallel to this would be Psalm 57. But if you come to First Samuel chapter 22, you see that David is once again departing from the place that he was, and that was up in the region of the Philistines with the king, Achish, king of Gath. And Gath is once again about 15 miles. So he runs, he's running away from him. If you remember the particular situation, we know that Saul had been chasing him. So he ran to Gath, probably thinking that, you know, if I go into enemy territory, he's not going to chase me into there, because there's a bunch of Philistines there. So he's not going to, so he's probably thinking in some way he's going to be safer. In his journey, he stops off, and he's hungry. He and the men are hungry. So they go into the place where the priests are, and he finds a showbread. Jesus actually uses this particular passage to begin to show the mercy of God in the midst of somebody even doing the wrong thing. So David gets the showbread, eats the showbread with his men, and he turns to the priest and he says, you have any weapons? And the priest says, well, I have this really big sword from Goliath. And he goes, I'll take it. So he takes the sword of Goliath, and it's interesting because as he takes the sword of Goliath, he then enters into the Philistine territory. So he has the sword of Goliath. And if you look with me in 1 Samuel chapter 21, it says this in verse 8, and David said to Ahimelech, now is there not a spear or sword on hand? For I brought neither with my sword or weapon with me, because the king matter was urgent. He's actually kind of lying there a little bit. He's saying he's on a mission for Saul, and he's actually on a mission from Saul, to run from Saul. But anyway, then the priest said, well, I have the sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom you killed. So pretty interesting, in the valley of Elah. Behold, it is wrapped in cloth behind the ephod. If you'd like to take it for yourself, take it. There's no other thing like this here. And David said, there is none like it. Give it to me. So David arises and flees that day from Saul, and he goes to Kish of Gath. So he cuts over to the west. He's over by Gath, and Saul sort of camps out in Gibeah, and there they sit. Now the perception is that you have the mighty sword. Of course, you're David, who killed the giant. You have the mighty sword of the giant. That should bring you some comfort. It doesn't. And as we come to the passage, it reads this way in verse 10. David arose and fled that day from Saul and went to the Kish king of Gath. The servants of Achish said to him, this looks like David the king. I think we recognize this guy. Well, you don't want to be recognized by Philistines. That's not a good thing. Did they not sing of this one and dance and say, Saul has slain his thousands, David his 10,000s? Wow. Can you think of anything more comforting? I mean, not only do you have the sword of Goliath, but you have your past in which, you know, you had the praise of men, and men were saying, he's the greatest, he's the greatest. You know, there's a lot of things that happen to us in our life, and there are a lot of things that we can embrace in our lives, but when all is said and done, they don't bring you peace or comfort. You know, we work so hard for the praise of men, right? At this particular juncture, it doesn't seem to be coming in handy. Does it to you? Yeah, it actually seems to put his life in jeopardy. So David took these words to heart and greatly feared the king. And so he disguised himself. Disguised his sanity, really, as the passage says. Interesting word that is used within the passage. Shana makes reference to almost a duplicity, which that fundamentally means that God was saying that, David, you're one way with one people and you're another way with other people. You're not really faithful. So in this particular text, David's really accused by God as being unfaithful to who he was. So he disguises his sanity before them, and he acted. You see that word acted in there? You're going to be surprised what that word is. It's the word halal. That's the same word that's used for praise. The same word that's used for praise. But what it's talking about, of course, is he shined, or he boasted, or he showed himself. And in this particular context, instead of showing himself shining for God, he showed himself feigning. So he acted insanely at their hands and began scribbling on the doors of the gate and let saliva run down his beard. The king said, "You see this man behaving like a man, man? Why do you bring him to me? Don't I have enough crazy people around me? Yeah. Get him out of here." Well, it worked. It worked. It is at this point that David goes to the cave. By the way, there is a particular psalm, just to let you know, Psalm 34, that is dealing with the feigning or the insanity. And Psalm 34 begins to deal with that. So chapter 22 is when David runs from, and he goes down to the cave of Adullam, and this particular cave, which interesting, makes reference to justice for the people. I don't know if he's seeking for justice or whatever, but it's a very interesting cave. I've seen a lot of pictures about it, and strangely enough, it's almost ground level. It's almost in a field, like, and you kind of see this bump, and then it just goes down, and there's a cave there. It's kind of like in the field. So it's very unassuming. And they figure that comfortably you could probably seat 40 people. Unfortunately, David will have 400 people with him. So it's kind of hard to hide in probably tight corners. But it reads this way in chapter 22, verse 1. So David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's household heard of it, they went down there to him. Now, I don't really believe that his family was empathetic. I don't believe the reason that they're coming down because they necessarily care so much for David. In fact, there's a particular psalm, I think it's Psalm 69, if you look there with me. Psalm 69, that begins to describe David's feeling about, feeling kind of alone, and actually some of the messianic emotions come out of this particular psalm. If you look in Psalm 69, verse 20, "Reproach has broken my heart. I am so sick. I looked for sympathy, but there was none, for comforters, but I found none. They gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink." That sounds familiar, doesn't it? So if you look in beginning Psalm 69, he declares this in verse 5, "O God, it is thou who dost know my folly. My wrongs are not hidden from thee. May those who wait for thee not be ashamed through me, O Lord God of hosts. May those who seek thee not be dishonored through me, O God of Israel. Because for thy sake I have borne reproach, dishonor has covered my face, How does yours read, verse 8? I have become estranged from my brothers. Another way of putting it is, I've become a stranger to my family. Another way of putting it would be, I've become loathsome to my family. And an alien to my mother's sons. It is this happening that will actually cause David to have zeal for God. Because up to this point, the concern was what other people were thinking, but David will ultimately turn from that and begin to say, zeal for my father's house has consumed me. And of course, that will become messianic as well. God oftentimes takes the rejection of our loved ones to bring us to a relationship with him. And so this is transpiring. You also have to remember that because Saul is after David, he is not concerned about who he's going to kill. So he would clearly, without any hesitation, take out the lives of his father, his mother, and his brothers. How do we know that? Well, all you have to do is, in 1 Samuel chapter 22, you remember the priest that helped him out, gave him the showbread? Remember that? So the king goes after them, and what does he do? He kills all the priests. 85 priests. So you know, you think you would kind of stop. I mean, some sort of scruples would say, you just don't kill priests. And it didn't seem to bother Saul. So his family's in danger. Now, you also have to understand that because of the fact that David's a fugitive, now his family's a fugitive, so they've been discomforted by this as well as inconvenienced, to say the least. They're not going to be happy about that. It kind of reminds me of in Mark where it talks about Jesus and all these people are coming to his house and people are cutting a hole in his roof to let somebody in, and his family goes, you're crazy, you've lost your mind. I mean, that's what his family said. So if you can imagine that they were upset at him with that kind of inconvenience, how do you think David's parents were feeling when they had to leave their home and hide in a cave with a bunch of smelly people? And I say smelly because they don't seem to be the greatest people to be with that begin to follow David. If you look with me in 1 Samuel chapter 22, he hides in this cave and his family comes with him. But if you also look who else is with him in verse 2, and everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt. Yeah. And everyone who is discontented or bitter. That's where we get the word Mara. Gathered to him, and he became captain over them. And there were about, how many? 400 in that little cave. I don't know. I mean, I've seen him put a lot of people in a Volkswagen, but I just don't know. 400 people. It's an amazing thing. What you have is David at probably one of his lowest points. I mean, he's clearly been running from Saul. Saul wants him dead. He was in the presence of the Philistines, and of course, they're sick and tired of people singing about him, killing them. So they want him dead. His own family aren't very happy with him. And they're stuck with him in this cave. I can imagine, you know, in that particular situation, you're looking at your family going, I said I was sorry. I mean, what else can you say? You said it 1,000 times. And what we know ultimately that he does, as you read ahead, have you guys cheated and read ahead? When you read ahead, he takes them to Moab. Now, we know why he takes them to Moab, right? Because Jesse's grandmother was Ruth, the Moabite. So they'll go, and so they'll actually have to, he'll go around the Dead Sea and go on the other side where the region of the Moabites are, which is quite some distance. What's also interesting is that he'll actually be confronted about him going there. Now, he goes to the king of the Moabites and he goes, can you take my family and take care of them because they can't go with me? I don't think it was probably safe that anybody go with David at this particular junction because, you know, criminals fundamentally were his band that were following him. So it says in verse 5 of chapter 22, the prophet of Gad said to David, don't stay in this stronghold. Go back to Judah. Well, what's clear is that in this particular setting, David was looking for some sort of escape. And if it meant feigning or faking, like he's some crazy guy, or if it means hiding in a cave, or if it means going to Moab, he's going to do whatever it takes to get out of this particular situation. David reflects upon this time and he goes, don't do any of them. Cry to God. And it's in this context that he reflects upon this moment. So we go back to Psalm 142 and we begin to see the heart of David as he teaches us. Now what separates this particular psalm from the other ones up to this point is the emphasis. And the emphasis of this lesson that he's going to be teaching us as he begins to reflect upon a past event in his life, the lesson that he's going to teach us is you've got to call out. And it's a very vocal point. In other words, you need to say it out loud. And so the way that he puts it in verse 1 is, I cried aloud. It's in the imperfect. We consider that it's more, he's reflecting upon a past, and it was imperfect, kind of gives a connotation of continual. In other words, I was crying to God. I kept crying out to him. The emphasis of the word, of course, crying is almost a shrieking, but it's very vocal. And his point is you think about it, it's an interesting contrast here. Because he's reflecting about the time in the cave. You can't reflect about the time in the cave without reflecting the fact that he was with the king of Achish there in Gad. So he was reflecting upon that. And you remember how he responded when confronted? He thought about these things in his heart, but he said nothing. He just acted like he wasn't even David at all. I can imagine that much of his thought was, you know, I should have said something. I should have spoke up. I should have been, you know, forthright. I should have cried to God and say, God, you saved me. But I didn't. And this is a psalm about not keeping quiet. Strangely enough, with difficult things in our lives, I know that we, you know, think about a lot of different things when you're going through hardship and when people are out to hurt you or there's all kinds of distress surrounding you. I know that you think about them. I know that you run through scenarios about them. All kinds of thoughts go through your head. But the question is, did you say anything to God? And this psalm, David's gonna emphasize, you need to cry out to God. No, with your voice. You need to do it with your voice. So the emphasis is going to be, I cried what? What does he say? Aloud with my what? Voice, right, to the Lord. I make supplication with what? My voice to the Lord, right. He'll repeat this again, in particular in verse 5, I cried out to thee, O Lord. I said, thou art my refuge. So once again, the emphasis within the passage is going to be the crying out. I cried out to the Lord with my voice. I make supplication, of course, supplication would just be another way of saying I cried out for mercy and God's favor. When's the last time you cried out? Does that mercy on me? You know, unfortunately, we're not only not reverential to God, but most of the time our crying is more complaining or even telling God what to do. But it should be more along the lines of crying out for mercy and favor. I long for you to be merciful to me. The way that it reads in verse 2 is a kind of an interesting picture of gushing out. So you can't read this particular psalm and feel like David is just nonchalant. You just can't read it. I mean, there's a bunch of gushing, there's a bunch of crying out. He's just letting it loose. I pour out my complaint. What he's talking about is his the musings and his troubles and his anxieties. I'm conveying to you what's going on. I declare my trouble before him. Another way of putting distress or making reference to distress, of course, obviously. Misery loves company because he had 400 others that were full of distress. I declare my trouble before him. Verse 3, when my spirit was overwhelmed, it's a kind of in the reflexive, it's an interesting word that is a picture. The Hebrew word is very graphic, isn't it? So there's a picture of a shroud over his spirit. And the picture is one of suffocating, and the picture is one of darkness. That's an interesting picture of overwhelmed, isn't it? Where you feel like you can't breathe, and darkness begins to cover over you. That's a great picture of overwhelmed. You can feel that with him. Thou dost know my path. What he's talking about there is that we all have our familiar ways of dealing with things. That's that path. We'll call it a well-worn way. You know, we go that way so many times, you can see it. It's just worn out a ditch before you. You know my path. You know my familiar way. In the way, look at the well-trodden would be the word there, in the way. Well-trodden where I walk. Unfortunately, because I have patterns in my life, evil men know those patterns. So it's real easy to put a trap up for me. They know exactly where I'm going. They know exactly where I am. They know exactly how I think. I mean, you know, unfortunately, evil people are very observant as well. His point is that you know and they know. And they're going to be hiding and concealing a trap for me. Verse 4, to me, really takes you into the heart of David. And takes you into the heart of sorrow. You know, sorrow and loss is really a lonely thing. You can have people say that they are sorry, that you're going through hurt and pain. I don't know. You have to go through it yourself. Because nobody else really knows the pain that you're feeling. So the way that he words it within the text, and I could just imagine... Here you are with 400 people that are in distress, bankrupt, and angry. And so you're feeling overwhelmed by your circumstances. And you start looking around and you go, I don't think there's anybody. You look at your parents and they're frowning at you. And you're going, okay, there's nobody here. There's just nobody here that cares a hoot about what I'm going through. So I look to the right and I see, and the picture is that when he's looking, he's considering, he's thinking, what about him? What about this person? Yes, sir.
So at this point, he had trusted people around him prior to this. Had he lost all those trusted?
Well, he had lost his most trustworthy friend in Jonathan. Yeah. And, God pushes us out of these places where we would tend to, of course, as we've talked about, David at first, at a very young age, there was no doubt that he wanted to please his father. There was no doubt that he wanted to please his brothers. He couldn't understand why they thought he was just a pest. And he couldn't understand why they couldn't be happy for him. He marries this woman that is given to him by Saul. And he thought that that would make Saul happy if he killed all the Philistines, and he did this. And so he marries this woman. This woman doesn't like him either. She thinks he's a joke. She makes fun of him. That comes in about a chapter later. So as you begin to read, almost everybody in David's life was either taken away from him or rejected him, the ones that he loved. Of course, his greatest rejection was Saul. I mean, he wanted Saul, he wanted to be a son to Saul. Because clearly his father, didn't see him as somebody to boast in. So he turns to Saul, and Saul will give him kind of hope for a moment, lets him play songs for him, but then throws a spear at him and tries to kill him. So, and now he's on the run from the person that he wanted. And he can't kill Saul because he's the anointed of God, and he doesn't want to. He doesn't want to. But he finds himself not being loved by anybody. I've often thought about the beginning of Kings, if you've read the beginning of Kings. And the interesting thing about, we were talking about this as you're reading through Kings right now. The interesting thing is, as you start off the book, of course, Kings is about kings. And your thought is, okay, who doesn't want to be king, That's the greatest thing that could ever happen. Well, the book of Kings starts off with the end of David's life. And as you read the end of David's life, you go, who would want to be king? Because as he's dying, the only thing that he gets, he has to hire pity. He has to hire care. Now, Abigail, his wife, Micaiah, his wife, he has Bathsheba, his wife, none of them are helping him. The only picture that we have is Bathsheba's coming to him and go, you promised to make Solomon king. Wake up! I just imagine, here he is trying to breathe his last, and she's going, you can't die yet until you sign the paper, Here's somebody kicking you while you're dead and trying to get more money out of you. So who wants to be king? The miraculous thing about David is that because we were talking about this, because God loved him so much, he is remembered and he is the beloved of God. So he is perceived as the greatest king that ever existed. But he is followed by Solomon. And in that particular day and age, you would have to say, well, Solomon's the greatest king that ever existed. He had the most money, the most wisdom. And no, it's not Solomon, it's David. And as Christ comes, who's he referred to? Son of David, right? Son of David. So, but as you look at his life, it's just one tragedy after another tragedy. He's clearly a man after God's own heart because he has a passion for God, but nobody else seems to have the same passion. You get somebody that feels very deeply about somebody else, and you stick them with somebody that could care less, and it's sheer torture all of their lives. They're tortured because they feel so deeply, and nobody cares at all around them. So that's what he says. If you look at the passage, I look to the right and see there's no one who regards me. There's no escape for me. When he talks about there's no one that regards me, he's literally saying there's no one that even considers or even notices what I'm going through. No one cares for my soul. Soul is such an appropriate word within the text because it's not only referring to the person, but it's referring to the person's emotions, their thoughts. Nobody cares what I'm thinking about. Nobody cares how I feel about anything. So, where do you go? Well, I guess you could live a double life and fake it like you tried. I guess you could try to hide like you tried. I guess you could run away like you tried. But David says, you need to cry out to God. Verse 5, I cried out to thee, O Lord. I said, thou art my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Portion is dealing with inheritance. We all think of, like when you say inheritance to people, they have all kinds of different thoughts. Most people are thinking money, but David's not thinking that. The word portion can mean two things. It can mean both inheritance that you would be given, but it also refers to fellowship. It's very interesting. So what it's dealing with is that you're my portion. You and I have something in common. We value the same things. That's why it's worded the way it is. You are my portion. He has found somebody that feels as deeply as he does. And it's one of the reasons why so many of David's psalms are messianic. I had nobody care for my soul. And you begin to hear, I asked for a drink and they gave me vinegar. Why does it segue immediately into the text? Because that's exactly the heart of God. And this is why David is referred to as a man after God's own heart. Because he felt the same way. He felt great passion. Zeal for the Father's house consumed him. So much so that his wife made fun of him for dancing and celebrating God. See? So everything that he did, perceived by the world, it was like he was just squelched on every corner. And he comes, like I said, to the end of his life, and he's not loved. He's not cared for. There's no empathy. But he did find somebody that did care for him. You're my portion in the land of the living. Give heed to my cry, for I am brought very low. The way of actually expressing weakness. It's hard to imagine that David would feel weak. This great warrior. Which seems to convey, too, that there is an evil that just doesn't stop being evil and it wears on you. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me. See the passage? See the words there? Referring to not only somebody being really hard, but determined to destroy you. They just don't give up. They don't stop. I mean, you'd like a break. You would like to just, as one of the Psalms when we read not too long ago, I'm for peace, but they're for war. It never stops. They just always want to fight. So when he says they're too strong for me, what he's making reference to is, of course, not that he is a weak warrior, but he doesn't want to fight. He's getting tired of fighting. Bring my soul out of prison. That's an interesting statement to make while you're in a cave, isn't it? But the prison that he's talking about is not the cave. The prison that he's talking about is the fact that he is, actually the word prison there means to shut in, or another translation is to shut up, which is interesting in the context, because how does it start off? I cried out. What was he doing when he was before the king of Achish? He was closed mouth. So what fear does is it causes you to withdraw and you say nothing. And the evil one would have you not express to God. There is a prison of sorts when you refuse to say anything that begins to bind you. And this is what the passage is referring to. Bring me out of prison. Why? Look at the phrase. So I can give thanks to you. Yeah. You remember the psalmist says, you know, I kept silent about my sin, you know? I said I'm not going to say anything, and I didn't even do any good. You can be so overwhelmed by things and trying to deal with them yourself is not going to help. I know that oftentimes the thought is, you know, if I cry out to God, I don't know if that's going to do anything. David is saying, just do it. Cry unto God. Bring my soul out of the prison so that I might not shut up. Speak out. Proclaim out. Give thanks to thy name. The reference to this is, by virtue of me doing that, it brings all those that are like-minded and like-hearted, and they begin to surround me. You know, in his distress and in his closed state, he was bringing and attracting all kinds of riffraff. But when he cries unto God, he attracts all kind of righteous. And it doesn't mean that the riffraff went away, but it can mean that they changed as they began to see hope for the first time. You can't help but feel that all of those that were surrounding him in that particular juncture, and you know, as you continue to read with David and you see his warriors with him, you remember the particular incident when he's getting ready to go in his hometown, Bethlehem, mm-hmm. and he goes, man, I just wish I could have a drink from the well of my own hometown. And his soldiers stand up and they go, we'll go get you the water. And they go risk their lives to bring him water. And they bring it back to him. And he goes, I can't drink this. You gave your life for it. And he offered as an offering to God. Remember that? You go, where did those men come from? These were the men. I gave thanks to thy name, and the righteous surrounded me. Thou wilt deal bountifully with me. He'll vindicate me. He'll greatly bless me. He'll take care of me. David is telling us that we need to cry out. We need to talk to God, but it needs to be vocal. So I've got an assignment for you. You have a distress in your life. There's something going on in your life. I heard not too long ago about someone in our body that was struggling with something, and literally it would depress anybody. And I get it. I understand that. You wish by telling, you know, a spouse that it would make everything better. I mean, quite frankly, there have been times that I've wrestled with things and I said to myself, I tell Connie I'm just going to make her miserable. I'm just not going to tell her, you know. Besides the fact that you ultimately come to the point where what could they do? So here's the assignment. You have something that is overwhelming, something distressful. Okay, I'm going to suggest, and I'm not going to say that you ought to go to the beach at this time. may not be the best time to go to the beach. But I'm saying go somewhere where you can scream and yell out to God. He wants to hear your voice. He wants to hear you cry out. You know, the evil one is trying to get us, don't say his name. Don't talk about him. Don't let people see you trusting in him. Although you'll see people walk down the street, you know, talking. It looks like they're talking to themselves. I know, you know, I told Connie, I says, you would think that those people were crazy, you know, but then you'll see this little earbud in their ear and you go, okay, well, they're talking with somebody. So it's kind of like normal now to be crazy. But there is a place where you can go. And what I'm going to ask you to do is be vocal with the Lord. I mean, there's no place. He couldn't sit down with his parents. He couldn't talk to his family. He couldn't talk to those people that were surrounding him. There's no way that he could do that. And quite frankly, in just a short moment, he could not go to the priests because they were all going to be dead. And it was his fault. It was his fault that those 85 men died. So as you can imagine, all of this on you and the realization that there's only one that can fix this. It's not only cathartic. He hears you. And this is the key point in this. This is not an exercise in hitting a beanbag. This is talking to somebody that actually cares. He is your portion. He thinks like you. He feels deeply like you. He'll answer you. Father, we come before you today and we give you thanks for this psalm that takes us into the journey of a man that was going through a lot of struggles. At a time in his life where he felt overwhelmed, he tells us that he couldn't breathe. Darkness was over him. There was just no way that he could see any way out. But he cried to you. He found something that actually worked. And he told us. Lord, we come unto you and we realize that your son did the very same thing in the garden. So it must be the thing to do to bring great blessing and great victory in our lives. We give you thanks for these words in your name. Amen.